Ruthie, where were you raised?
Philadelphia.
Oh my, where in Philadelphia?
Valley
Temple. I was raised, so you know my connection.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't know my, I was the second rabbi there.
I was
there a full year, re-elected by nine, I think, in my book I have the exact details, 9-7, 10-8, what you call a Pyrrhic victory. But Baruch Hashem, we went on from Valley Kinwood. Okay, today is, everything is recording, both are, okay, thanks Danny. Today is Monday, September 10th, 2012, and here we are in Gris Kollel in Yerushalayim. Yeshiva University, as I explained yesterday, has a branch that still functions, we hope will continue to, in the Holy City. First of all, I want to say welcome to all my tired students sitting in front of me who have gone through the Slichus ritual. And I want to say hello to those listening across the world who may not be tired by the time they listen to this year. I also want to pass around, like I did yesterday, everyone attending this year, please print your name clearly. Give me one word of background, where you were raised, and whether you're in the smicha program, what's your smicha. And Be'ezrat Hashem will learn the names. Now, once again, I say one word of introduction, repeating and highlighting what I alluded to a week ago. The Monday morning class is very different than the Sunday morning. Sunday morning, I'm teaching myself. I want to know all of Shas and Peskom. I want to know Kol HaTorah Kula. I will never know it all, but at least I keep on trying. And I told you the vod from the Rav Talmud Chacham. If you think you're a Chacham, you're finished. We always have to know we're a Talmud striving to be a Chacham. Or as I quoted yesterday from the Stechemed, Lo Alecha Malacha Lidma, but don't forget the other part. Ve'en atab and torrently he batel me menu pekei avat. In the Monday class, which began about 2 years after the Shas and Poskim class, Shelet and Chuvat class, the students pleaded me to comment on contemporary events, Hashkafa. And it began, I believe, 1980, and since then I've never repeated a shiur. As I explained to you, I spent 22 years on the Rav, out of which my fifth and sixth books developed, The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. I then went into the history of Torah in modern times, which took on to 4 years, and then I spent 10 years, questions my students have asked me, and attempted to humbly give answers. Now, because of the age factor, even though, thank God, when I look at you, I feel much younger, but simply this trip to America was enough to put whatever few hairs I have left to get rid of them. I saw all my friends and contemporaries and colleagues being wheeled to hear my shiurim in wheelchairs, and it's not a happy feeling. So I want to get out of my system knowledge, which I'm beginning now, it'll take a few years, but this is an area where I want to say it humbly, I have what to contribute. I don't think there's anyone else left alive who yet spoke the people who spoke directly to Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. But when I say no, anyone else left alive, someone who appreciates it, understands it, has studied it, and can put it into context. So I want to do Be'ezrat HaNatan Liyov Koach, the history of Torah in modern times. Now, as I told you last week's lecture, and part of this week's lecture is nothing unique and nothing special. I simply wanted to give an overlook of what the history of the Jews in the United States was about, to give you a framework. And then Be'ezrat Hashem, I want to fill in the framework of that which is of interest to us, and it's especially meaningful to us. So as I said, the Jews came to America, and the original settlers in America were Sfardim, Eidot HaMizrach, but not the Eidot HaMizrach that we capture in Israel. These were not Moroccans, these were not Tunisians, these were not Algerians, these were Spanish Portuguese. Very elegant, very sophisticated, with a very I would say a supercilious attitude towards Ashkenazim, because the Ashkenazim had not tasted part of the Enlightenment, the great world yet, And as you know, the Sephardic Jews, the golden period in Spain, the Maimonides, Nachmanides, and you have a tradition here of elegant Jews who both can live in the Torah world and live in the great world beyond. Of course, America's America, and even though Jews arrived here in 1654, absolutely nothing remains of them, and I quote it to you, and it's a volume, if you can get hold of it, it's a volume worth going through, Professor Greenstein's History of the Jewish Community of New York, where you see that at first the Mechallel Shabbos was thrown out of the shul and denied burial. And of course, 20, 30, 40 years go by, and a Mechallel Shabbos, nothing wrong with it, it's wonderful, only the rabbi has to be Shomer Shabbos. And you develop that Catholic concept where the clergy takes vows of poverty and vows of obedience, and the average layperson, if I may quote a Yiddish pun, lepta chaza shetag, and boy, that really is a double intender in this case. You know what that means, Ruthie? Lepta chaza shetag, how do you translate that? High in the hog. But you understand, a chazer is asa. In Yiddish, it sounds a lot better. Lepta chaza shetag. All right. Nevertheless, with all the breakdown in religious observance, and I gave you more illustrations last week, fixatious is a very prominent, powerful, example. With all that, nevertheless, the community in the United States started to feel its responsibilities in the 1800s. Now the Germans have come in, the Bavarian Jews, and I explained to you last week how America became real. My vote from the Lubavitcher Rebbe with the newspapers and the Shul Haif, it's worth thinking about. And I believe we hit the nail on the head that the Civil War made it real. Everyone in Europe wanted to follow what's going on. And as the Jew integrated on the American scene, as he made it financially, he became his brother's keeper. And I spoke about three events that greatly challenged the American Jew. Damascus blood libel, 1840, the question with Switzerland, the cantons, and the right to accept the Jew as an American citizen and give him privileges as an American in Switzerland when he was traveling. But above all, the 1858 Matara kidnapping. The Matara kidnapping, how the temple guard, I told you the story last week, I don't want to repeat it, but I just want you to know that I received correspondence from Henry Zuberman. He already heard last week's lecture. And according to an article in the forewords, Rufus Liarsi, remember I told you his name was Sophie Israel spelled backwards. His real name was Israel Goldberg. And I send out a question to all the people listening, do we have any information on who Israel Goldberg was? Be interesting to know. Was he a rav? Did he have smicha? Was he a trained historian? And because the book is a very wonderful book, and you see that it's someone who knows about Torah, he understands the Torah community. He also tells me the Matara case was written up by historian David Kurtzer, and I was correct on what I told you, that Matara, my memory, I studied this when I was in graduate school. He became a monk. Remember I told you he was part of the clergy, and it's exactly what I told you. The Pope one time met him, and the Pope said to him that because of you, we paid a very heavy price. Because what ultimately happened was that most of the temporal kingship that the Pope had in Italy was taken away. They no longer had vast estates and power because the Matara case simply made people sick. He adds one comment here that is worth mentioning. My particular prejudice is that all Menahalim should be required to read this book about the Matara case because they will understand how much the Pope valued one Jewish soul. And here I just want to tell you in parentheses, truer words were never spoken. When you go into chinuch, you have a kid, he's a troublesome kid, you got to remember it's dinei nefashot. If you throw that kid out, you're pushing a kid away from Judaism forever. And I don't believe there is a kid alive that you can't get to his heart. You have to figure out how. And I can tell you I'm a very bad example. Of course, I taught on every level. I began in 1959 on an elementary level. I taught high school beginning in 62. I taught college beginning in 69. And I taught postgraduate beginning in 78, where I wind up today. And my wife always yelled at me. She said, there's something the matter with you. You never had a student you didn't love. And that's absolutely correct. I had students who were tzaddikim and students who were rishayim, murderers, gangsters. I love them all. Did they all straighten out? I don't want to say all, but I have a very good track record, and I needn't elaborate. So I very much value that statement that the Pope, for one Jewish soul, gave up billions of dollars worth of real estate. Alacha kama makama, when we are machanchim, how careful we have to be. And you have to understand, the kid is a kid. There can be a Yetzirah. He can overcome it. I can tell you, in my own family, there was one kid that wanted to throw out of Choruf High School. Idiots. All right. You should see what that kid is today. What a Talmud Chacham. What a Yerei Shemayim. What a Ben Torah. All right. You have to give a kid chance. You have to. Sometimes you have to give the kid candy. Sometimes you have to talk. How many kids I spoke baseball with. I can tell you stories. Tell you one story out of Chinuch. A kid graduates from Oz. It's a true story. I'll mention his name. Eric Davis. It's maybe in the 1980s. He goes to HaKotel. HaKotel is too intense for him. He has my son-in-law in HaKotel. If you know my son-in-law, Rav Chaim Eisen, he does not have my personality. Take my word for it. He may have my hashkafa, but when you see him, you stand up, you give kavod hatorah, you see an adam gadol, rakefet, a little worm sneaks in. So this kid switches to BMT. It's a true story. His parents told me about it afterwards. These are people who were very big in Lincoln Square, and father might have even been president for a while. And the kid is now in BMT, in this building. And they tell the kid, we're going to have our best teacher. And the kid finds out, he's coming into my class, that I'm Rabbi Eisen's father-in-law. And they tell me the kid is petrified. He makes a kal vachomer that of Rabbi Eisen. And this is his father-in-law. And the kid is shaking, and you had to see me in the college class. I took attendance. I was strict. It's not like postgraduate that I'm afraid of you. College, I ruled. And the kid, and I take attendance, and I say, and who is this new youngster here? And this kid is shaking, and he gets Eric Davis. And here the Rebbe, Eric Davis, the outfielder from the Cincinnati Reds? Oh my, what a pleasure to welcome you, Eric. His parents told me at that moment I changed this kid's whole life. He was a star, basketball player, sports. The Rebbe knew, all right, Eric Davis happens to be Afro-American. The kid happened to be Caucasian. But it didn't matter. I accept him as Eric Davis. Finally, he has another part to the paragraph here that I evidently said something about pomegranate, the high-class Galat Kosher market. He says, on trivialities, I shop at pomegranate. There are relatively few chassidim who shop there, and the prices are not so very high. For some items, they are cheaper than the commercial supermarkets. Specialties are pricey, but you are paying for convenience, service, and accessibility. I just want to say to Henry Silverman that compared to ShopRite, they are expensive. The Rebbe stands on his words. Okay, now, the German immigrants, of course, responded and became Jewish conscious in the sake of Chesed. I said the Torah last week, they built hospitals. Every Mount Sinai hospital in America originally began Jews Hospital. And they, these Germans, built these hospitals. This was their Chesed. This is the way they developed. By the 1870s, the East European immigrants started to come in. And of course, you have the Great Divide. And you see it in Israel. The Ethiopians are demonstrating that there's prejudice against them. If I had time to waste, I would go over to a crowd of them. When I come back from the Kotel Friday night, they have some sort of Sabbath service there. I would speak up and say, when we Americans came, they were anti-American. This is the nature of the beast. Every wave of immigration hates the next wave. And Lahavdil, this happened in the United States. The Germans looked down at the East Europeans. I told you the cartoon I saw in graduate school. We were once like this. These Jews came with bekishes, with beards, with payas. The American Jews were integrated. And you reach a crescendo with RJJ's funeral, Rabbi Jacob Joseph, the funeral, the riot. We'll come back to all this in detail. But New York shapes up. And for over 100 years, you have not had a major anti-Semitic incident in the New York Police Department. And this is a fact. The last major, you're always going to have, look, you can't say everyone is going to be a philo-Semite. You're always going to have prejudice. There are plenty of Jews that say, my kid brother served in the American army. So my kid brother was in Hawaii, he was in communications, the Korean War. And my kid brother wore, and he was not a chaplain. That Rabbi Rubin wore a kippah in the army is not a chiddush, but my kid brother wore a kippah in the army. He said occasionally an anti-Semite would say something to him. Though he says the black Americans would kill anyone that would say a word against his kippah, against his kashrut and Shabbat. And my brother never ever let me use the word shvatza. So, you know, you can Jews, you can, chas v'chalila, we should show prejudice. Every human being is a human being, period. And you give every human being the benefit of the doubt. And I believe that every human being strives to be good, at least until the world teaches him otherwise. There's an neshama in him. So the New York Police Department shaped up, and the Jew is at home. World War I already, you have for the first time unity. Unfortunately, just like Israel, in Israel, if you've ever been here during a war, there is such unity, it's indescribable. If you're here before a war, there is they kill one another, and this is par for the course. Read Haaretz, read Maariv, read Yediyot, read Makor Rishon, and boy, you have seen a major boxing match. Now, what can I have the... Okay, now, World War I, Josh Gutenberg, okay, G-U, okay, Josh. World War I united the Jews. And I told you about the Orthodox, the Central Relief Committee, the People's Relief Committee, the American Jewish Committee, and an all united in the Joint Distribution Committee, which goes on until today, doing wonderful, wonderful, wonderful work. And I've known many people who were involved with the JDC. It's something really to be proud of. Bye. And let me, now I'm picking up new material. Josh, by the end of World War I, American Jewry is the focal center of the Jewish people. All eyes turn to America. Europe is impoverished. Palestine is struggling. Everyone turns to America. And now in America, you not only have German Jews who have made it, and some still remain Jewish, but you have East European Jews who have conquered the United States. I don't have to go any further than one example that we all know the name. We'll come back to him in detail, Harry Fischel. You talk about Harry Fischel, you're talking about the heart of East European Jewry, comes to New York penniless and goes on to become a multi-millionaire. If you want to have any idea who Harry Fischel was, then I'll show you the picture when I come to him in detail. But it's one story that you can repeat 1,000 times over. He becomes a builder, and he builds big buildings. And he builds on, I believe it's the Upper East Side of Manhattan, builds this large building, many stories. And one part of the building you'll see, they're just two stories and nothing above it. And you want to know why? Because he lived on the second floor, and that was his sukkah. He had a sukkah that he would take off the roof. It was a roof all year. Sukkah's time, he would remove the roof and put schach on, and he gave up rentals of about another 16 stories, one room less, just that he could have a sukkah. So this is one of many. There were other great names, Mendel Gottesman, Nathan Lamport. These were East European Jews, Hasidish Jews, and they made it in the United States. The greatest proof that America was America, America was the center, is, well, you tell me. A guy named Rakefet was once named Rothkopf. Once in college, he, third year college, won a $50 prize for research. Had a fight for that prize, wouldn't be given to him easily because some professors claimed American Jewish history is not any history, it's a history of assimilation. What did he do his research on? The 1924 rabbinical visit to the United States. And you have to understand, all eyes were on America. The yeshiva in Europe are starving. The yeshiva in Palestine are starving. Josh, how do we get money? And they send the delegation to America, three rabbanim, the Kovner Rev, Rav Avram Dovber, Kahana Shapiro, the Dava Avraham, the most famous rabbinic position in Eastern Europe, in all of Europe. Vilna had no chief rabbi. Those of you who have studied with me know why, but if you don't know, we'll come back to it at a certain point. But there was no chief rabbi in Vilna. Kovner's chief rabbinate was the pristine position. This was the Lajon, a graduate, the Kovner Rav, Rav Avram Dovber, Kahana Shapiro, the Rav Avraham, Rav Avram Yitzhak, a Cohen Cook, chief rabbi of the Ashkenazi community in Palestine, and the most famous Rosh Yeshiva of Moshe Mordechai Epstein of Slabodka. Could you imagine three giants together come to America, stay practically a year, a campaign to raise $1 million. They never raised $1 million, but they did raise, I understand, over, if I have to check my scholarship, but onto $400,000. That was an astronomical sum. And this was America. America was the center, was the focal point. There was no other place to go. Not England, not France, but the United States. The Jews have great political influence already. In a democracy, you vote, a ballot is your bullet. You have influence. Democracy, if you're familiar with Alexis de Tocqueville, and you should be familiar with him, he was a French social scientist who visited America before the Civil War, I believe it was the early 1850s, and he wrote a massive study of democracy in America. And of course, he shows the faults of democracy. And there are faults to democracy because you pander to the masses. If it's not like a kingship where a king, Malchut Beit David, a king has to have the best interests of his people at heart. In a democracy, you lower the taxes, wow, you get elected. Aye, hospitals have to close, roads can't be built, the army can't function, but the people are dancing in the streets, the taxes are lowered, and shalom al Yisrael. Daniel, I want to tell you that the name of the main Abraham who we spoke about is Danny Abraham. So you not only are not related, but you're not related, and you're still named after the same person. Daniel Abraham. And you can understand the Jew has political power. How does this reflect? Who was Senator of New York State? Who later is the governor? Senator Lehman, governor of New York State, Senator of New York State. Herbert S. Lehman, a nice Reformed Jew coming from good German stock. If you ever saw what his grandparents looked like, you would understand who he's coming from. The Supreme Court. There isn't a time already where you don't have a justice on the Supreme Court who is not Jewish. Cardoza, you have famous names. Frankfurter, Brandeis, a university is named after him. Arthur Goldberg is Gogaven Yiddish Mensch, had a lot of Derech Eretz. He arranged for Dershowitz a Shomer Shabbos stage in Harvard when Dershowitz was still a normal human being, was still a Jew, still you don't understand what Dershowitz did. This was all arranged for him, and he threw it all away. And I told you there's a lot more to the story. I don't, my memory lives on. And you have to know the family Dershowitz comes from, you understand. Abe Fortas is a name you don't know. Today in the Supreme Court, of course, there's no longer, you know, one, what are there, three, four members of the Supreme Court? No wonder the Ku Klux Klan claims that America is run by the Jews. All right. Supreme Court, Jew has power. Jew has influence. What's fascinating is that as smart as the Jews are, and you all know Romney's beautiful speech in Jerusalem, Josh, right? You're familiar with it and what he said about the Jewish people. I was in America at the time. But let me tell you, Moshe, he became a hero for Jews like myself. He hit the nail on the head, and the answer is very simple. Mir Ligon and Larin, whoever heard of another people, that 92,000 people turn out to celebrate the completion of 7.5 years of study, daf by daf by daf by daf, and we learn and we continue learning. Mikam Chayisrael Koyachad Paretz. We're a wonderful people with all our problems. And well, you know what's amazing? That no one foresaw the Hitler, how bad it would be, how terrible it would be. You take some of the leaders of the community, I'll mention a name, Cyrus Adler. Does the name mean anything to you? Cyrus Adler was of good German stock, was a lawyer, lived in Philadelphia, was a Shomer Shabbos, was a Shomer Shabbos Jew. And he later becomes the head of Jewish Theological Seminary. He administers it. He was not a great Talmud Chacham, but he was a fabulous administrator. And he beats the head of Dropsy College. It's a well-known name. He was very active in JDC, in the committee that ran it. Cyrus Adler left a memoir, I Have Considered the Days. It was published in 1940, Jewish Publication Society. You find no reference to Hitler, practically. The Jews totally misread the map. When you take the Zionist leaders, you take Stephen R. Weiss, you take some of the Zionist leaders, the Reform rabbis, they totally didn't act on their own. They were sold out to the State Department. And you all know from the literature, the doctorates, the research that has been done on World War II, if the State Department told them, don't say a word, don't make it public, don't make it known, don't let anyone talk about it. The Jews were being killed by the tens of thousands every day already. And the leaders of the Zionist movement were under the thumb of the State Department. It's a very, very, very sad chapter. I needn't tell you, and this is a concept that we've come back to in Halacha and Drush time and again, if you know the Rav, the Hesped Rav Chaim Moisa, the demonstrations against Hitler. Agudat Yisrael opposed the demonstrations. Madison Square Garden, Netanel, please close the door. Agudat Yisrael was totally opposed, Yoni. Stadlanut. Even on that issue, no one really went wild against Hitler. And it's a fascinating chapter, and it may very well explain why American Jewry Ke'ish Echad stood up to the communist empire. And I'll quote from Mori Rebbe, and I wrote this up in the Rav, and it's absolutely so. The Rav said a number of times in public, we should add one al-chait. And you know, we're coming into Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, Josh, a big list of al-chaits, a big list. Milk, how many of those sins did you do? Ribbono shel Olam, I don't want to boast, but I can tell you, most of those sins I did not do. No, I don't believe I don't believe Yaakov Slebiak did most of those sins. How come you say it? So already the Goyim, the Rishonim already discussed it. We don't want to embarrass the Jew who did do the sins. So we all say it together. The difference is, all right, if I'm saying it, I don't have the same kavanah like a Jew actually did the sin. So the Rebbe said we have to add an al chet for a real chet that we did. Al chet shechatanu lufanecha sheshamanu kol tzakat achenu me'erapa velo asinu dai velo asinu maspek. I'm quoting Rebbe word by word. We didn't do enough. And this may explain why post-World War II we rose as one person to help our brethren in Russia. Now, let me make one more comment, and then we can get into the heart of the course. And this is a very important insight. You talk about religion in America. When the German Jews, the Bavarian Jews, started coming in 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, they brought Reform Judaism with them. Reform was 19th century classic American Judaism. What am I saying? No, how many of you studied American history? Go west, young man. Conquer. What was the whole concept of the frontier? You went, you did whatever you want, you killed as many Indians as you want, you set up cities, you robbed, you stole, you cheated. You could do whatever you want. Wild West, no law, no order, no civilization yet. This is reform. You throw away the whole past, do whatever you want, and reform in America went to very great extremes. Abolish Shabbos? No, the big temples, when was their main day of worship? Sunday, just think for a minute, memoir literature, Temple Emmanuel. Who needs, there was a whole machleket whether you should, like today, the same machleket today, Bris Mila. Except today, all the medical literature shows Bris Mila is the most important gift you can give a male child. The literature today. In the New York Times had an op-ed piece a few years ago that every child born in the world should be required to have circumcision. Could you imagine what we've lived to see medical science? But we don't do Bris Mila because it's healthy. We do it because HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded us. But in America, they threw away Shabbos. They wanted it. Bris Mila remained the machloket. If you're familiar with the Pittsburgh Platform, 1885, it remained in committee, panim lekan v'panim lekan. It remained the teiku, do, don't do. Threw away everything. Davening, Kabbana, Palestine, Yerushalayim. America is my Palestine. New York is my Jerusalem. Okay? 19th century. Reform was American as apple pie. Then you come to the 20th century, and you'll start to understand what happened. Who piled in? Who are these millions of Jews? 3 million Jews in America by World War I. 2.5 million are East Europeans. The East Europeans came, even if they weren't religious, but the shul they knew was a shul, was a shtibl, was a machitza, was a women's gallery. Rabbi Joseph H. Luxney, when he would visit Israel, he would boast to the Eltera, to the Rabbanim here, I'm the only shul in New York that has the women walking up 2 flights like back home in Europe. And you know, they, of course, we used to call him Little Joe, but let me give him cover, yeah, but what Rabbi Lichtenstein, what you don't know about Rabbi Lichtenstein is, in the 1940s, KJ, Kehillat Jeshurun, Josh, have you ever been in KJ? You got to go to Mikveh before you, it's the most important Orthodox shul in the world outside of the state of Israel. Take my word for it, I know what I'm saying. That's number one. Could be Beth Jacob in Beverly Hills is number 2, and Fifth Avenue Synagogue is number 3. If I've davened in all 3, it means I have davened with the equivalent wealth of about $20 billion. You understand? So what Rabbi Lichtenstein, what you don't know, is he had 40, 50 people Shabbos morning. So he decided maybe the solution is to bring the women downstairs, to build a mechitza and bring them downstairs with a little mechitza and a Jewish center. He was jealous of the Jewish center. In the Jewish center until today, the most prominent Orthodox synagogue on the west side, if you don't know that's a mechitza, you can trip over it. Right or wrong? Come on, it's amazing, the year 2013, they still have not built a proper mechitza. To me, it's amazing. The whole world has moved so right, and Dortmund, a bastion of Torah, Rabbi Young, Rabbi Lamb, what a shul. Anyway, so Rabbi Lichtenstein wants to roost the mechitza. So he has a meeting of the board, and he's telling them their plans, and of course, Rabbi Lichtenstein ruled KJ, the board is not going to argue with him. The next day, his president, Max Etra, tells him, Max J. Etra, legendary president of KJ, all my degrees are signed by my president of Yeshiva University. Max says, Rabbi, I just want you to know you can do what you want, you're the rabbi, but if you build the mechitza downstairs and bring the women down, I can't daven here anymore. And you know, Max Etra is not exactly a sapma chassid, what's going on here? He looks, and Rabbi Lichtenstein says, I know this from my way, says, Max, what's the problem? He says, Rabbi, I went home and I told my mother what you plan to do. My mother said she can no longer daven here if you do that. That ended all plans for bringing the women's section downstairs in KJ. But you see, in the average Orthodox synagogue, what happened? You had a second generation. Listen to me very carefully, because if you understand this, you have the key to understanding Torah struggles in America in the first 75 years of the 20th century. A new generation was growing up. These kids couldn't be reformed. The Elkin haben geredet Yiddish. Sie haben gedammt in der Stiebel. Sie haben abgegeben der Cheret zu einem älteren Rav. These kids couldn't be reformed. But they couldn't be Orthodox. They're American kids. They want an English-speaking rabbi. They want a service that's not so long. Their wives. They need a woman next to them, you understand? All right, when they're on the golf course, their wives are not there. But outside of that, a woman has to be next to them. Ah, conservative Judaism conquered the world, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. How many graduates of Yeshiva College, of Chaim Berlin, of Teira Vadas? You talk about Philadelphia, the leading conservative rabbi was a Teira Vadas graduate. Must have done something right, because he has descendants living in Ephrat, Shem, Torah, Mitzvah, Baruch Hashem. Don't want to mention his name. Half the classes in Yeshiva College went to the seminary. The seminary then? That was American Judaism. What characterizes America? The melting pot and the pride, ethnic multiplicity. It's America. How do they call New York? The mosaic, the population, black, white, every different language, Jew, Catholic, Protestant, Muslim, Dominican, every country, Yordim from Israel, New York, the mosaic. Conservative Judaism was perfect. The melting pot. It's not like an old Orthodox synagogue where women walk up two flights, where the rabbi retno Yiddish, and you remember, do you know what a spittoon was? Do you remember who studied with Rabbi Lux? They knew Rabbi Rubin, tell the class about the spittoons. Do you remember what he told us? He had to get, you know what a spittoon was? I had sword and shoes. People used to chakken. So they used to have a spittoon in the shul. No, in the modern world, you can have spittoons in a shul and expect to attract kids brought up in America. And Rabbi Lichtenstein had to fight a battle. Rabbi, we had a spittoon in Europe. We had a spittoon on the east side. Downtown on the east side. Now that we made it to the Upper East Side, we're not leaving the spittoons behind. They had to fight battles. But conservative Judaism was perfect. The melting pot. I'm an American. A woman, Virginia Slims, smokes in public. My wife sits next to me. My mother sits next to me. My daughter sits next to me. How did those ads go in the 1960s on every subway car? New, help me out. A family that prays together stays together. And you see the father, mother, son, and daughter, the quintessential American family praying in a temple, Protestant, Jewish, a church. Beautiful. I'm an American. But ethnic multiplicity. I'm a Jew. I'm not Reform. I'm a Zionist. I still believe in some sort of kashrut in the house. Okay, when I travel, I eat fish in a treif restaurant. What can I do? It's America. We have to, you can't starve, pikuach nefesh, whatever. So we abolish yontif sheni. It's America. Who observes? Who ever heard of Shavuot in America? Sukkot has mazel. It's next to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Pesach, of course, everyone knows, let my people go. Go down Moses. The blacks gave us Pesach, if not for their hymns. How would the American Jew know about Pesach? But you see, following World War II, the conservative movement was triumphant. The march was unbelievable. And you can ask many of my classmates, or I can give you names. I later taught their children right here in this kollel. Why did your father go to the seminary? What happened? And you always get the same answer. They really believed that the future of Judaism was with the seminary. They were Shomer Shabbos. The seminary was Shomer Shabbos. They were Makpid and Kashrut. The seminary was Makpid and Kashrut. Everyone ate in JTS's cafeteria. It was 100% under top hashgacha. Shabbat, the Professor Finkelstein put in 1947 is the famous story that he gave the boys in the dormitory a gift. He gave them Shabbos clocks, timers. And at that very moment, the rabbinical assembly was debating whether or not you can use electricity on Shabbos. And he gave them so you take the mechitza down. So look into Astor Janovsky, who was a professor of sociology, a Jewish guy, at the City University of New York in 1940-41. He published a book on the composite portrait of the American Jew. And there's an article by Rabbi David de Sola Poole, who was rabbi of Spanish Portuguese, who was an Orthodox Jew 100%, whose wife was a Yerushalmit. Tamar was an Ishiyut, a personality on her own, a learned woman, a Melumedet, fabulous woman. And he wrote an article, he said, the only mechitzas that will remain in America will be in the Spanish Portuguese synagogues. The one here, Mikveh Yisrael in Philadelphia, the one in upstate, where was the other one, where Rabbi Correa was rabbi, Rhode Island, Dale Providence, Rhode Island, they'll be the only ones that will still have a mechitza, because that's traditional, it's part of the tradition. Everyone is not that firm, but a Spanish Portuguese synagogue has to have a mechitza. Outside of that, this will be the price we will pay for acculturation in the United States. There will not be a mechitza. And without going into great detail, I challenge any rabbi in this room to find me in Dalet Chalkei Shulchan Aruch one word about a mechitza in a synagogue. I challenge you. Yaakov, you're not a rabbi yet, but you're going to get there one day. Dalet Chalkei Shulchan Aruch. Challenge you. One word of there is nothing there. So either you can look at it the way the conservative movement looked at it, Nishkefelech, we don't really need a mechitza there. Or you look at it the way Rakefet looks at it, that it was so axiomatic to Jewish life. You don't find one word in Shulchan Aruch Aruch Haim, when you wake up, you have to breathe. Of course you have to breathe. If you're alive, you have to breathe. A mechitza was part and parcel from the time we became a people, Oz Yashir Moshe B'nei Yisrael, and afterwards, Vatetzei Hanashim B'tuba, the women davened separately than the men. This is the nature of our existence as Jewish people. It is from the dawn of the Jewish community. Okay. One other point that becomes very, very important that affects every last person in this class. A sea change happened with the conclusion of World War II, and even the late 30s it began. For the first time, and I'll go into this in great detail later on, for the first time in the history of the Jewish people in the United States, tzaddikim, ga'onim, chassidim, anshei ma'aseh, came to America, not because they wanted to, but because it was pikuach nefesh to save their lives. Until the mid-1930s, anyone who came to America, take my grandparents, take my wife, has yet great-great-grandparents buried in Queens. My wife's family's in America from the 1870s. Some of the Malachim were part of her family. We're going to come to the, you know what that means? A Malach, Malachim. No? What do you know, Charlie? Ever hear of it? Mori? Baruch Hashem, the Rebbe has what to teach you. Thank God. No, no. Baruch Hashem, you guys have achieved a great deal, but thank God we have what to teach you. Some of the Malachim is part of my wife's family. I'll show it to you later. See, until then, if you would have asked my grandmothers, I had two grandmothers, like everyone else in this room. One grandmother from Kovno, from the most meyuchistic family. I later found out who we're related to. My mother always used to hack me ahead who her mother was and that. And I didn't pay any attention because yichus is not that important to me. But I found out, Baruch Hashem, 2 years ago, I have big yichus. No wonder I'm sitting here. I have another grandmother who I didn't know of any yichus. So you should know, the grandmother with the big yichus, God have mercy, what happened to that family in America. If my grandfather, who learned in Balash and went to Shul Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur and maybe some Chasteira, I'm doing okay. My other grandparents, no yichus. My grandfather never learned. All he could do was read Ivri. He was a Baal Tefillah, but I don't know if he knew what the words meant. Never Mechallel Shabbos. But if you would have asked them, when they passed the Statue of Liberty and people are throwing their shekels into the water, their tefillin into the water, we have eyewitness accounts about this. You would say, why are you going to America? What will be with your children? You're risking everything. They would say, yeah, we know, but what can we do? We're impoverished. We have to get out. We have to get to America. They were taking a risk. And they knew they were taking a risk. And 90%, there was a big machlokes, Chaim Soloveitchik and others, I don't want to go into detail now, with Rupture and Reconstruction, if you know what I'm talking about. Chaim's article where Chaim claims everyone was ruptured. But Professor Mark Snyder and others, there was a remnant that survived the 1910s, the 1920s, the 1930s. But now with Hitler, Jews are coming to America to save their lives. And they are determined, if I can quote the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe, "Itvech machin America v'di'altehem." I will turn America no different than the old country. And the Rebbe said that, black and white. I have the 7th Rebbe, there's a Fabrenian, years later, I think it was 30 years later, celebrating 30 years since the Rebbe, that's when the Rev went. This was in 1972. It was a few years earlier. Lubavitch spent over $1 million enhancing this video. It's very powerful. If you have a bit of a Hasidic soul. Thank God, over the years I've developed that ability. You watch the Rebbe, he talks about his father-in-law. He is powerful. But that message, America will be no different than the old country. And these people, with that determination, changed the entire world. Look what we have today. Yeshiva University, it's not the Yeshiva University I went to. I don't believe there's one person in this kollel who starts to understand who Rav Soloveitchik was. You can't. You understand Rav Aaron Cutler better than Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. And I'll come to it. I have entire lectures prepared on this. To understand the Rav's Breitkeit and humanism and Western civilization. Ah, you guys. Learning and Panasa. All right? You're different than, let's say, some other yeshiva. You got to go to high school. You got to go to college. You got to take it seriously. You got to go to graduate school. You got to make a living. Fine. I don't see you reading Plato for the sake of reading the Republic and appreciating it. You understand? The world changed. Let alone Torah Vadas. Torah Vadas broke with the Malachim because the Malachim were too firm. Today the Malachim couldn't get into Torah Vadas. And I know what I'm saying. Chaim Berlin, look at Rav Huttner. Okay. You look, I don't want to look. Took off the picture of his Rebbe. Took off the picture of his Rebbe. I don't get excited about that. I like a Talmud who's loyal to his Rebbe. But Rav Kook's picture came down and he became a synthesis between Epsal, Litvisher, Rosh Yeshiva, Chassidic Rebbe. The whole world changed. Look at Satma. Look how powerful they are. Look at Bavav. Bavav is some story. Because the Bavav Rebbe didn't want to be a Rebbe in America. He came to America to entirely gebrochen and entirely destroyed by the Holocaust. His whole family wiped out. If I'm not mistaken, he sold insurance for a while on the Upper West Side to support himself. Take a look. The Chassidim came, Rebbe, we have to have a Rebbe. We have to go further. He understood they needed encouragement. Look what Bavav built. I walked into Bavav in Borough Park on Shabbos morning. I know I can't daven late. I wake up early. I daven early. I can't leave Kriyat Shema for 10 o'clock. I'm sorry. But Malkanar, we took a walk. We went to Bavav Plaza. We walked into immediately 50 people fell on top of me. Lekarevote. I guess a guy walked in without a beard, without pace, without black clothes. Turned out I taught 101 relatives of theirs. When we started to talk, who they are, who the family, where they come. Oh my God. Bava, look what Lubavitch did in America. So you see, you got to understand Torah in the United States. At one time, Reform Judaism was on top of the world. Following World War II, everyone believed any Jew will become conservative. This is American Judaism, melting pot, ethnic multiplicity, the right dosage of each. And take a look today, Shezachinu on the front page of the New York Times, 92,000 Jews come out to celebrate Siyum Shas. You have no idea the impact that made.
92,000
was
all nice people. I would say it's a great achievement. You have no idea how well a Chilul Shem is.
What?
People learn Gemara every day and does not influence their behavior. Can you imagine such a thing?
Yitzchak, you are at fault. You have to be an example. This is when I see a Jew who lived in my apartment building in Yerushalayim and lived there for 12, 15 years, Einiklach, of Rav Diskin, who gave the chayrim against learning English. You should see what came out of that man. When I see his great-great-grandchildren and they saw me every Shabbos, and they didn't change, I'm at fault. I have to reach a level that the Chafetz Chaim said. Remember the Chafetz Chaim traveled around giving Musa and got nowhere? And then he went back to Raten and he basically never left again except for conferences with the Chaim Isa in Vilna. And he stayed. And the cup, you have to be... Remember the mashal the Chafetz Chaim gave? The cup has to fill, it has to overflow. Mindafsen Kedusha V'tahara. I'm at fault. You're at fault. Don't talk evil against any Jew. 92,000 came out to learn Torah. Kol HaKavod. That they're not all tzaddikim, I agree with you. But that's the nature of the beast. What can we do? A human being. Why do we need a Yom Kippur? Look at all those Al-Khaits. Who would ever dream that in Flatbush Borough Park there would be murderers? Murderers would keep putting their heads. Okay? Do you want examples? Let me not give them. I can give you four examples, including the famous case that everyone knows. There are others as well. Dai l'chakima. But we are at fault. Baruch Hashem. Ani rak model HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What you fellas don't realize, you don't see all my students. Malka was overwhelmed. On the streets of Borough Park, people are running after me for a bracha. And I say, these people see through me at least they understand where I'm coming from and where I want to go. Baruch Hashem. My dear students, we have arrived. Let me continue with any other names I have to learn or everyone's a follow through. Daniel Abraham, I know already. Josh Guttenberg. Josh, the first Jew in America to dream of building Torah. He was so insightful. This Jew, whatever he tried to do, ultimately became real. He was way ahead of his times. And yet, in his own lifetime, he was a total failure. So much so that almost nobody knows the name today. Isaac Lisa. Zeched Tzaret Levracha, spelled L-E-E-S-E-R. Now, let me just say a few words of Machshava, because this is very important. The Zohar says, and I spoke about this when I dealt with the B'Samim Rosh, because the B'Samim Rosh, a number of years ago, similar example. Hakol tului b'mazel, afilu sefer Torah shebehecha. In life, mazel, whatever you want to call that word, my wife's grandmother didn't speak much English, but she used the word, you should have mazel. Was meint das mazel? Luck. Good luck. Good luck. Mazel. In life, without mazel, you can't get ahead. How do you define mazel? So I always say, the ultimate mazel is to be the right man in the right place at the right time. And I'll give you an example from my own life, because I don't want to use other lives. Talk about myself. I started out in life in Lower Merion Synagogue. Was that a mismatch? Read Washington. Read what I quoted from Charlie Liebman's research. Vic Geller, who placed me there, says until today it was the biggest mistake. I was a kid out of yeshiva, 23 years old. What did I know about the world? These were sophisticated, modern Orthodox people who had a dream that they could be Makarev everyone to Yiddishkeit. If you walked in with a pen in your pocket, no one said boo. But if you look too frum, they told you you look too frum. All right, so I was the wrong man, maybe in the right place, certainly at the wrong time. Okay, now let's shoot ahead. I come in Aliyah. Not the way you come in Aliyah. Today on Friday's paper, there was the big article in Yediot on this young couple that got married yesterday, are coming in Aliyah today. My grandsons will know the young man, Katz, from Hakotel. He's going to medical school in Technion, where I have a grandson in medical school. He's going to be in the American division. My grandson's the Israeli. My grandson said he's going to look him up for me. They write about their Aliyah, one phone call to Nefesh Ben Nefesh, and they take you through the whole process. That's Aliyah. That's Eretz Yisrael, Niknei B'Yisurim. That's a farce. What schar do you have? It's like living a half block from the shul. You get schar halicha. I came 69, unwanted, uncalled for, unsought. My wife goes to the dentist for the first time. She comes home crying. I thought the dentist was painful. No! The dentist said, you're an idiot. You left America. You came in Aliyah. You're a moron. Every Israeli wants to go to America. And you, born and bred in America, came in Aliyah. Ribbono shel Olam, come, when, here, sir. But I was the right man in the right place at the right time. And it's all in Washington. 1969, BMT opens. I'm on the first faculty, 10 students, and I was the right man. I could talk in learning and I could talk baseball. And wow, did we change the world. who would ever dream if someone would have tapped me on the shoulder and said, Ani, because of this beginning, hundreds of thousands of Anglos are going to come to Israel and study Torah and become B'nai Torah, and tens of thousands are going to come in Aliyah. And you're going to play a big role in changing the face of this country. I mean, what are you, crazy? What are you, a moron? There are 10 kids in front of me. By the way, not all these kids are alive anymore. I write about Michael Fool, don't I? God have mercy. But in life, sometimes you have, you know, mazel, the wrong person, but he's in the right place at the right time. Or the right person, but never the aggravation he has because he's in the wrong place at the wrong time, etc. And you all can understand this, and there's much more Divrei Torah to say. The Rav talks about the Tfilat Vidui that we say in Yom Kippur, in Lo Shenotzati Eini Kedai, that if we would be born before our times, it's a vod from Rav Kook, he would always quote, we couldn't be successful. The fact that God put us here in this time, at this day and age, we can be successful. We have to try. We're here. We speak the language. We have the mentality. It's a nice, a beautiful thought. I want to say about Isaac Lisa, it breaks the heart because he was the right place, the right man, but the wrong time. And let me begin. His years, first of all, to put him into context, 1806, 1868. He was a sickly man. He was near death at one point in his life. I'll give you the details in a moment. He never married. At least we have no record of his having ever married. And obviously that affects his gestalt. It affects his interpersonal relationships. Let me give you a little bit insight too, because this too you see in his life. To the best of my knowledge, there has not been a definitive study done of Isaac Lisa. I'll give you what I consider the best article I know of in a moment, but there has not been a definitive study. Professor Grinstein, who also never married, once told me, I'm going back many decades now, so Professor Grinstein, Chaim Bogomilsky, we all love to pick on his middle name, which happened to be his mother's family name, Bogomilsky. Hyman Bogomilsky, Grinstein, once said to me that some lady began to do research on the life of Isaac Lisa, and he discovered some love letters that he did have a girlfriend at one time, and she desisted. You know, she was afraid she would reveal secrets that she didn't want to reveal. All right, I guess she was afraid she'd wind up like making a vagoda like Reb Nosson Kamenetsky when he reveals that, that you know, that I consider that the high point of his book. You have to have a litvishish sense of humor, but you know what I'm talking about, right? That Rabbi Zalman, the Altar of Slabotka, made a shidduch between Rabbi Zalman Meltzer's daughter and Reb Aaron Cutler's Talmud. And it seems Reb Aaron Cutler wrote a letter to his wife-to-be, to his fiancée. And Rabbi Zalman got very upset. Whoever heard of a chatan v'kala corresponding? In those days, you looked at each other once, you made a shidduch, and you saw each other under the chuppah. So he complained to the Alta of Slobodka. So the Alta said, I promised you a gong, not a tzaddik. But I want to tell you there's going to come a day when the world will suffer because of Rabbi Aaron Cutler's tzitkut. So it could be she saw the flatters. By the way, I gave a whole addendum on this in public, the hundreds of people that reached Rabbi Lam. I said, what did he write to his girlfriend? I believe he wrote love letters. And I said, perhaps if our chatanim were taught how to write love letters to the woman they're going to marry, we would have a lot more happy marriages and a lot less divorce. Let's learn from what Reb Nosson Kamenetsky writes about Reb Aaron Cutler, the importance of writing a love letter. Now, Reb Nissen loved what I said, but he said he doesn't know. He never saw the letters, so we can only guess what was in the letters. But anyway, the best article I know appears in Guardians of Our Heritage by Leo Young. I'll tell you about Leo Young in a second. What
the editor or is it the author?
No, the editor. The author is Moses Isaacs and his daughter Nancy Klein. And it begins on page 247. Now, let me just give you a little bit of background. Leo Young, Rabbi Dr. Leo Young, who we'll talk about in detail but not yet, was a great fighter for Torah in the United States. And he was rabbi, came to the States at a time in the early 20s when, you understand, Torah was on the defensive. And he felt that if we published, if we wrote articles, if we went out and met the people with information, we would have much more success. He edited many books of biographies of Gedolei Yisrael. He edited this as part of the Jewish Library, it was called. He edited books that dealt with contemporary problems, but as Yitzchak said, he is the editor. He's not the author. Now, Moses Isaacs and Nancy Klein, do you recognize the name Isaacs? Anyone recognize the name? This is a very unique family from Cincinnati that arrived in Cincinnati right after the Civil War. And it's a family that has remained 100% from dedicated, committed to Torah until today. And it's just a legendary family. One of the Isaacs was professor at Harvard University. One of the Isaacs was the dean of Yeshiva College. If I'm using the word dean, it could be at a different title yet, but it's the dean as we would know him today. The Isaacs were totally opposed to Zionism. They were real German Orthodox Jews following in the Hirshian tradition. Zionism is not permissible, etc. To the credit of the Isaacs, many of them became great Zionists with the formation of the State of Israel, and endless Isaacs and their descendants live al atmat HaKodesh. There is a lady who goes around preaching she was my student in Michlala. What name does she go by? Shira Isaacs? Or does she go by her marriage? Shira, what's her name?
Smiles.
Shira, thank you. Shira Smiles is Shira Isaacs. I had her as Shira Isaacs. She is a descendant of this family. So that Moses Isaacs and Nancy Klein, this is a father and daughter writing about Isaac Lisa, who functioned right before their family arrived in America. Now, the life story of Isaac Lisa is fascinating. He was born in Germany, and his mother died when he was young. He was brought up, he and his brother Jacob were brought up by the surviving father, the grandparents. He evidently had a good education, if not a formal education, but an education from his grandparents in Shas and Paiskim. He knew how to open a Gemara. He knew how to learn. When he was 18 years of age, his uncle invited him to America. The uncle was doing very well. He was in Richmond and in Virginia, and he succeeded in his business, and he wanted his nephew to work for him. His nephew was impoverished, his nephew was orphaned, his nephew didn't have a mother. He adopted his nephew and brought him to the United States. So Isaac Lisa comes to America working for his uncle in the business world, but concomitantly, while he's working for his uncle, the shul in Richmond, Virginia, the Sfadik shul, is looking for a chazan. Now you have to know, in the Sfadik community, the rabbi plays a very small role. It's the chazan who many times is also the chacham, which is the equivalent of the rabbi, who sets the stage, who leads the services, who teaches the children, and he becomes the chazan in this shul. After about 5 years, the same position opens in a very elegant, important Sfadik congregation that exists until today, Mikveh Israel, Mikveh Yisrael in Philadelphia. And where do you find the chazan? They're looking all over America and they hear about this young man, and he goes to Philadelphia. And it's in Philadelphia that he achieves fame and acclaim, although he constantly has his run-ins with the Balabatan. And here I'll just elaborate and come back to what I said a moment ago. He never married. Chazal tell us, Masechet Sanhedrin, if you don't have children, you cannot be a member of Sanhedrin. Do you remember the Gemara? Why? Mipnei she'azari. Because it's very simple. If you don't have children, you have never made a compromise in your life. Daniel, when do you go to sleep at night? You're the boss. When do you wake up at night? The minute the first child is born, Moshe, from that moment on, you are no longer the boss of your life. And it's a Baruch Hashem, a life sentence. Even when your own children or grandparents, they're still going to call you and bother you and come to you and ask for advice, thank God, and guidance. And this is being a parent. And being a parent, you learn very quickly there is give and take, there is compromise. I would extend Chazal to say, not just if you don't have children. If you don't have a wife, you also can't be a Rav. You also can't be involved in cloud business. Because if you don't have a wife, you're self-centered. You remember what I told you, why the woman walks around the man 7 times. I like my vat. I'm still, I still think that I'm correct, that Ruthie is not correct. I like my vat plain and simple, because the nature of the beast is that a man is raised a gatlet adam. I learned in Slabodka, I come gehet shmuasin from the out of Slabodka. The world is created for you, the world circles around you. Suddenly you get married? So the feminists don't understand. The woman walks around the man, not as a sign of servitude, just the opposite. That this man should wake up, that this woman, everything until now has been 7 times, hevel havalim. And now you have to live for her, not for yourself. It's a different mahut, a different stage of life. He never married. Fought with the Balabatam. You see, finally in 1857, his friends organized his own shul, Bet El Emet. And there he remained until his death. It was like a shtibble. What's the difference between a shul and a shtibble? In a shul, a rabbi is subject to the whims and wishes of the Balabatam. They elect you, they pay your salary, you have to come crawling to them, you have to renew the salary, they appoint the committee, a whole machlokes over the contract, should it be for 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 6 years? No rabbi should take a contract for more than 6 years, because then it's a tshuva of the chatam sofa. More than 6 years, you're an eved ivri, you understand? You're an eved olam, and that's no good. But the truth is, a rabbi should strive for life tenure, but life tenure is worthless if the neighborhood changes. Rabbi Chalap has often spoken about this, how when he got life tenure, he thought he's finished, he's set for life. Little did he dream that 10 years later, he wouldn't even have a minion on Shabbos morning in his shul. So what good is the life tenure? But he remained in Bethel till the day he died. He had smallpox in 1834, and his brother was the only one who visited him and sustained him, and brought him food, and his brother died as a result of the illness because he was so good to Isaac. And this evidently impacted upon his life. They say there was a certain tinge of sadness, an overtone of sadness, that the man carried with him, not having married, losing his only brother who was very close to him, and endless little arguments with Balabatam, who wanted to compromise, wanted to Americanize, felt he was too firm, too demanding, too unyielding. Anyone who is in the rabbinet here can understand the words I'm saying. Okay, now, he was very upset with the American scene, and he came up with the first monthly, call it journal, newspaper, pamphlet, The Occident, OCCIDENT. What does The Occident mean? You can look the word up on Westerns on a Bridge. It means the Western world. It's like the new world, in contradistinction to what you left behind. And I believe, and she doesn't say it, but my own educated guess is, he was influenced by Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch in Germany also, his followers put out a monthly magazine. Rav Hirsch always contributed articles. They were always trying to reach out to the people. The written word was extremely important, and he felt that this could be achieved in America with The Occident. Now, Rav Hirsch's articles, those of you familiar with Rav Hirsch, the Gesammelte Schriften, you know what I'm talking about? Later, all his articles in Yeshurin, on all his periodicals, wherever Rav Hirsch wrote, were collected, I believe it's 8-9 volumes, Gesammelte Schriften. Now we are privileged. Everything has been translated into English. Put out by Feldheim, the 9th volume just came out. You don't even realize the machlokes behind these volumes of Rav Hirsch. Does anyone know what I'm talking about? It's very simple. Rav Hirsch today is being portrayed as a kanoi, a right winger. Rav Hirsch was unbelievably open. He was a kanoi 100%, but his hashkafes, he wore clergy robes that we would never put on. We'd look like goyim, we'd look like Protestant ministers. He was very open to the big world, very open to literature, very open to all the knowledge that had been achieved in the Western world. Today, they portray Rav Hirsch, I don't have to tell you, the Baruch Be'el Leibovich and Birchat Shmuel and Kedushan, I'll go into this, but not now. But he portrays Rav Hirsch, it was a heter to go to college, b'di'evet, it's not la chatchila, and it's a very negative attitude towards Rav Hirsch. So now let me tell you a little story. When I was doing my research for my doctorate on Rabbi Revel, I corresponded with Rabbi Breuer. Why did I correspond with Rabbi Breuer? Because Rabbi Breuer was brought to America, Rabbi Yosef Breuer, by Rabbi Revel. Rabbi Revel saved his life. So Rabbi Yosef Breuer put the correspondence in the hands of his assistant, his son, Rabbi Jacob Breuer. And Rabbi Jacob Breuer and I had a whole correspondence, and he was very sharp in correspondence with me, ripping the hell out of Yeshiva University. In other words, it's true that they saved my father and my father, but I can't, my father did not approve the way the Yeshiva, and he didn't have to write that, and it really was a shtach. But the years went by, and I don't say we kept in touch, but we knew of each other. Vayehi Hayom, and he also was not married, very fascinating. Later on, he retires, he marries a widowed second cousin. He comes in Aliyah to Israel, and it falls his lot to hear me speak on Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch. There are eyewitnesses to this, because Morty, don't believe what I'm telling you. It couldn't have happened. Maxwell, you'll ask, there are eyewitnesses. I finished the talk on Rav Hirsch, and Rav Jacob Breuer comes running up, you know, a real yuck. He never left Frankfurt with the yuckish beard, the whole deportment. And he hugs me and kisses me. And he says to me, I want you to give this talk in Washington Heights. I'm writing out a check now for your car fare and a little extra. I say, Rabbi Breuer, who will pay my life insurance? Did he laugh? Did this? Yeah, we became best friends. So then he revealed to me that when they came out with the first volumes of Gesammelte Schriften on Schiller's 100th birthday, this was a German author that Rav Hirsch loved, okay? He gave an unbelievable talk on Schiller, his writings, his humanism, his dedication, and the Balabatim in Hirsch and Breuer's didn't want to publish that in English. And he says, I regret until today that I didn't fight them tooth and nail. My dear friends, in the final volume of the Gesammelte Schriften, which just came out this past summer, there is the eulogy 100 years later on Schiller. You understand? So, and I can tell you already, there was a lot of bitterness. People claimed that the volume is not accurate. They made it up. The family said this is exactly what Rav Breuer said. It's been published. It's been printed. You understand? Lisa was like Rav Breuer, the accident. Do me a favor. Danny, talk with Rabbi Bednash. I gave some money when my mother died, Zichrona Livracha, Reni Kaparat Mishkava, to buy Sferim for Gris. We split, my brother, we split the money three ways. We did three different charities. Check with him if the Gesammelte Schriften, and I ordered all nine volumes should be here in English. If anyone wants to consult them, it should be on our shelves. We shouldn't be ashamed of Rab Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. The accident, fighting the battles that we take for granted today. But more than that, he was very upset with the American scene that shuls could change minhag, do whatever they want. He was opposed to having Ashkenaz and Sfad. He said, the minute you get involved with Ashkenaz and Sfad, you are telling the people majority vote decides. If majority the vote decides, they can change the shul and become reform a minute later. His dream was there would be one minhag, and that minhag would be in every American shul. Now, I'll mention this next week. I'm not going to have time now or 2 weeks from now. He was not opposed to Minhag America. In other words, Isaac Mayer Weiss dreamt of Minhag America. If it would have been in consonance with tradition, he would not have been opposed. In the accident, he fought many battles for an old problem that every Orthodox shul or every shul has in America. No, the decorum. And he was very upset. Now, and you have to understand, this is a real problem. Because you go into the church, Lahavdil, there's decorum. You go into a Catholic service, there's decorum. You go into a Protestant service. Of course. How long do these services last? 1 hour. I grew up in a Catholic neighborhood. They went to Mass. 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. I used to look at them. They leave at 5 to 9. They walked out. The church was down the block. They're home by 10 to 10, 5 to 10. If they're talking outside the church, so they come home a little later. Well, a person can sit still for 1 hour. Look, you say the shiur began 9 o'clock. It's almost 10:30. I haven't heard a sound from you. But imagine if the shiur would be 4 hours. And in the middle of the shiur, we start making mishaberachs. And then you make a mishaberach. Yedeinu hatakrank, you know. It's Jews. It's amazing. When a mishaberach is made, you might think the whole Jewish people are in a hospital. The names, it's endless. They're people that specialize. They go, oh, the guy's making a mishaberach. 20 names he reads off. It's like he collected names. Okay, I don't know. These are real problems. He writes, I quote to him now from an editorial in The Occident. Quote, we regretted to observe in the place we attended that many spent the Kippur day, sick. It's Yom Kippur, but Kippur day in running in and out. And we must pointedly condemned the practice of rounds of visits to various places of worship on that solemn day, for such intrusion disturbs the devotion. That's like Simchas Torah. In Yerushalayim, there are people who dance from shul to shul, Simchas Torah morning. I don't have to tell you, Simchas Torah Mela. I'm not happy in Yerushalayim, because Simchas Torah here is really Shmini Atzeres. It's not a time for all the frolicking, but okay, Minhag Yisrael is to carry on like a goofball on Simchas Torah. Beside, you know the story in Boston, the Chazan got up Simchas Torah night and started the Niggun of Yom Kippur, and the Rav gave a clap and gave a look, and boy, did he go back to a serious Yontif Niggun. But all right, you can't change the world, but on Yom Kippur, but this problem of lack of decorum, time and again, Isaac Lisa raises the issue, the lack of decorum. What are we doing about it? And he fights. And this becomes, you'll see, this becomes very important for reasons none of you can imagine. But I'll show you next time we meet this battle for lack of decorum and what it does for Isaac Lisa's memory. You will not believe it. And let me make one final point. It's a very fascinating article. Hashgacha was not a problem. Why? In those days, you made everything on your own. So what's Hashgacha? Matzah for Pesach? Shechita? But it's not like today. Every product, if you look, an OU, a Chaf K, a Triangle K, can you use it? Can't you use it? It's the CRC. I mean, I have to tell you, there are hundreds and hundreds of symbols, including I have Talmidim in Hashgacha. They also have their own symbol. In Hashgacha, you have a lot of phonies, right or wrong. I don't want to tell you. I know cases that, for money, what so-called rabbis will do, including one guy who was a classmate of ours. He's no longer alive. It's unbelievable. There always were phonies. What Yitzchak said, unfortunately, was always true. There are always going to be Jews who are phonies. What were the phonies in his day? Not Hashgacha. Hashgacha, you baked your own bread. You milked your own cow. You brought the eggs in from the hen. Hashgacha was not a... people used to come around selling tefillin. I have a pair of tefillin. This is from Europe, yet was made by a tremendous cipher and this and that. And these tefillin were American-made tefillin. You were lucky if the pashas were kosher. There was fakery right down the line, mainly in his time, with clay kodesh, with tefillin, with mezuzot, with all types of claims that came from Europe, and he would cry out against it. You got to give him a lot of credit, but we're just scratching the surface. You'll see his major ideas, and he saw nothing in his lifetime, basically, but every last idea came absolutely true, pulsating, achieved, tangible, by the year 2013, where we are today. So to reiterate, I want to just comment on one machloket going on in the world today. To reiterate, what have we done today? We finished out our brief survey of the history of the American Jew, and it gives you a bit of a background. I now want to dot the I's and cross the T's. And the first person, there were other ordained rabbis in America, but they didn't have massive influence at all. And Baltimore Rabbi Reis, with limited influence, Isaac Lisa was already a Jew who saw the future. His influence, or at least the attempt, was overwhelming. He was the first. He was not a rabbi, had no ordination, had no smicha. But he was a Talmud Chacham. He knew how to learn. He knew how to quote a Maimon Chazal. You see it from the accident. And he started fighting the battles that engulf us on the American scene. Of course, what we spoke about now are minor battles, but the decorum in a synagogue has very far-reaching implications. because it gave birth to the reform movement, to a certain degree the conservative movement, and until today we struggle with the problem of decorum. It gave birth to Esh Kodesh. Those of you from Woodmere, from the Five Towns, know what I'm talking about. That is a shul where in order to become a member, you have to sign a pledge and pledge your life that you will not talk during davening. And it's my Talmud, he's like a Rebbe there. He's a BMT boy, a Yeshiva College boy. But he may be in Bayer, why you Musbach? He's an ace. Excuse me? I don't know, he went to Gris. I recall having him in BMT. Maybe I had him in Gris too, could be. Kol hakavod. So you see, that's a real problem. But this is Isaac Lisa, but we're just scratching the surface. Wait till you hear the next year. Okay, now I just want to comment, and then I want to give it to someone in the Kol, if anyone wants to read it in depth. World War III broke out in across the world, and two of my colleagues are fighting, and people ask me my opinion, and I have to tell you, I reach a taker. I wrote back to the people who sent me this that I cannot take sides. I'm at a taker. The problem is very simple. Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik in the early 60s, mid-60s, gave a famous talk, Confrontation, against dialogue with the Catholic Church. It was the Ecumenical Council. I'm sure you know the details. And the Rav came out 100% opposed. We have to go our way, they go their way. We have to be civil to each other, but we cannot speak in theological terms. Rabbi Riskin last May in Makor Rishon, which is a very important paper in Israel and may be coming more important because Makor Rishon is about to buy Mariv. And I don't know if you understand the implications that you're now going to have a major newspaper, not just a secondary newspaper, that believes in Torah and Zionism and everything that is sacred to us. And it brings Mariv back to its sources. Who was the founder of Mariv? Kalbach, part of the Kalbach family. And he left the will that Mariv should never be anti-Zionist or anti-Torah. And of course, that will is observed like any other will 20, 30, 40 years later, Shalom al Yisrael. So in Makor Rishon, Rabbi Riskin, Steve Riskin, one of my classmates, a little younger, but we sat in front of the Rav together, wrote a major article in Makor Rishon that the Catholic Church has changed and we have to have dialogue. And you have to see the article, well documented. Rabbi Riskin does something, he does it well. While I'm in America, everyone comes running to me, Shabbos, I think I was in West Hempstead, I forget already where I was then, Shabbat. And Rebbe, did you see Rabbi Heschel Schachter's article against Riskin? I say, no, they show it to me. Evidently, it came off a website, and Rabbi Heschel gave a tremendous talk against Riskin. And he says nothing has changed, and the Catholic Church indulges in converting people here, and we can't have any correspondence with them, and a very strong article. About 30-plus Jewish organizations that deal in Jewish-Christian relations bitterly, caustically attacked Rav Schachter. You don't know what the facts are, and they don't indulge in converting Jews, and you had no right to publish this article, and Rabbi Riskin is right. And Jonathan Rosenblatt, another Yeshiva College graduate, made this into a major issue in Jewish Week. From what I gather, if I understand the correspondence correctly, and Rab, there's a professor, Mark Steiner, who I know, whose mother and my mother went to kindergarten together 100 years ago, literally 100 years, not figuratively. And so I only know Mark 100 years. So anyway, if I understand correctly, the Lichtenstein family asked who's the ranking expert in this. You're not going to ask Rav Keffer to look into this. You're not going to ask, I don't know, Rabbi Bednash or Rabbi Miller. The ranking expert is Rabbi Dr. David Berger. Right or wrong, he's the man who did his doctorate on Jewish-Christian relations. So he looked into it, and he wrote a whole article, Interesting. The article is in, oh, it's in Hebrew. Okay, the article is in Hebrew. I saw an English addendum. I thought, because I read Hebrew and English interchangeably, and sometimes I quote an article, I say it's in English, it's in Hebrew. Sometimes I say it's in Hebrew, it's in English. He wrote a long article in Hebrew where he shows that the Catholic Church has changed, but on the other hand, their ultimate dream is that everyone should be converted, so it's not black and white. You ask me, halacha l'maisa, no one will take Reb Heschel as a scientific scholar. So you have to understand, when he writes, he has a reputation like this, and he doesn't have a doctorate, and he isn't a scientific scholar. He's a gaon in Torah, but he's not a scientific scholar. So when he speaks, there are things he said which are not correct, which can be offensive to the Catholic Church. That should not have been said. On the other hand, whether we have to revise Moriah Rebbe's position, I don't think so. I think we have to make it clear on a human level, a civil level, we can be friends with every religion in the world. It's mutual respect. We have it very easy because we're not allowed to proselytize. We believe Chassidim Olam Yeshlem Chelik LeOlam Haba, and there's one reading Kiyisrael. It's in Pirkei the Rebbe Eliezer. So we don't have to convert anyone. But to go and revise and have dialogue today, I don't believe we should or we could, and I don't believe Rebbe would be in favor. But I may be wrong, and I want to ask Rabbi Rubin's opinion, who's a much bigger expert than I am on this topic.
Firstly, when the Rav wrote what he wrote, his behavior and his own performances that deny the text of the article. He appeared, and I went to hear it. He gave a lecture on the, which appears in the book on Out of the Whirlwind, the Religious Significance of Suffering. This appeared as a lecture in which Catholic priests were in attendance. He appeared in Boston before church people. But not now, there's a difference between the Catholic Church and the Protestants. Herschel Schechter is a very great colonel. He's an ignoramus. Christian beliefs. I'm sorry to say, because the one group that has changed 180 degrees
right.
are the Catholics. They came out and actually stated, which you and I, can you and I say we're embarrassed that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wrote that all the Kananim should be killed, and the women and the children? We can't say that.
Not after Hitler, I have no problem.
No, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was the author of the Torah.
Right.
And we cannot, and whatever he writes, it's Kadosh Das. How can the Catholic Church come ahead and say the Jews of today are not responsible for the sins of their fathers when in their text it says they can't change Matthew and Luke, where it says that Jesus said that they killed them, and that they, and in the book of John, chapter 8, what is it? It's chapter 8, verse 33, he says specifically, he meets the Jews, who are you? We are the children of Abraham. And he says, you're not the children of Abraham. You are the children of Satan. Can you imagine such a horror? Because if you believe in Christian theology that the world is divided between the forces of good and the forces of evil, people who are with the forces of evil and have it in their DNA, they are the enemies of Hashem.
Right.
So, along comes the Pope in 1960, and he said, the Jews of today are not responsible for what their fathers did. He can't change that because it says it's geschrieben in their text. That the Jews did it. So this was a tremendous change. And then Isaacs wrote his book, and they had an influence.
Which Isaacs?
The one from France on the, I forget the title now, but he listed 23 different points in which church teaching was against Jewish people. And as a result, they came up with a document in which they talked about notre aparté
right.
in our time, in which they came out and they said, the Jews are our relationship, they are the elder brother.
Right, right. That's quoted in here. Okay, so I can gather that Rabbi Rubin agrees with Rabbi Riskin. And if I understand David Berger correctly, he reaches a teiku. And little Lonnie Rothkopf, who's an Amaritz in this sphere, I would bow to David Berger.
See, the Rav said he doesn't want to discuss theology because he didn't want to go into polemic and disputation. But if he talked about the concept of Tzemach HaMokir and the implications of Tzemach HaMokir, And that HaKadosh Baruch Hu trusts us. And and this is a basic Jewish doctrine. Or if it goes into the whole idea of the distance of God, remote, Elohim, transcendental, and Hashem, immanent, close, and this is a chiddush, that the God who is immanent is the God who is transcendental, one is the same. The God of Rosh Hashanah is the God who sits on the kisei of Mishpat. The Zelva Rabbeinu Shalom sits on the kisei of Rachmim and Yom Kippur, and it's not a contradiction.
Got it. Okay, gentlemen, I just want to apologize. I know another class has to come in. We'll leave the other discussions for the future. I want to remind you that next week, due to Yom HaDin HaGadol VaHanora, Rosh Hashanah, we don't have class, but we do have class the week of Yom Kippur, Sunday, Monday, and then we pick up again after Sukkot. And I just want to state, let me see if I have two copies here, I thought I had three. I just want to tell you, what I say during this year about being born at the right time, I was born before my time. What a world you live in. These are about books that are on sale now in honor of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot. You can get entire libraries for pennies. And I know you'll say, what do we need all these Sfarim for? It's all on the computer. But remember, you have Shabbos, you have Yontif. I still don't know a computer that works on a Grumma switch. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya. Yitzchak, you want to go through this and give me your opinion after you've read it? If anyone wants copies, they were giving this out, Erev Shabbos and Shuls.
They have now a Gemara, Daf Yomi, for children.
Unbelievable, I know, I saw that, unbelievable.